Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
I'm Kayla Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening to the Not a Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving podcast. Right, I'm happy to say that we're back with a brand new episode. The last couple of weeks have been reruns, as it were, because I was laid up with a really nasty back problem, which was not the best start to the year for me, to be honest. A complete nightmare. I think if you've ever had serious back problems, then you will empathize immediately with anyone else who is having them. It's genuinely one of those things that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. But I am happy to say that I am back in the game and we are back on schedule. So just before we get started with this week's guest, I've just got an announcement to make regarding Hot Flush Bandcamp policy. So if you listened to my double header solo pod on Bandcamp last year, you'll know that the concept of allowing people to pay more, or allowing people to pay what they want, I think essentially, for stuff on Bandcamp is a really key aspect of the platform, which is not used that extensively in dance music Bandcamp. So doing the research for those episodes really piqued my interest in the whole thing. And as a result of that, we have decided to change tack with what we do on the platform with Hot Flush, which is my label, of course. And that change going forward as of today is to make all of our catalog items pay what you want. So if you go onto hotflush.bandcamp.com now, you will notice that all merch items, which is to say t-shirts, mugs, but also vinyl records and CDs and cassettes, are pay what you want. Now there is a guide price, which isn't really a recommended price. What we've got up there is a approximation of what the cost price is. So you can see what it costs the label to produce. And past that, it's really up to you what you want to pay for it. Now we're just doing catalog items because we don't want to be undercutting record shops on new releases. Record shops, as we've said many times on the show, are a crucial part of the scene, crucial part of the ecosystem, and we don't want to be screwing those guys over. So it's catalog items only. When we do a new release, it will be priced, you know, equivalent to what you would pay on Juno or Hardwax or whatever, and we're going to be sticking to that. Digital downloads will still have a minimum price, but bear in mind when you buy the physical copy of a release, you always get the downloads for free as a result of that purchase. I mentioned it's merch as well as releases. We do have a Hot Flush label tee, the classic logo on a tee, up for pre-order today, and that is pay what you want. So yeah, we are really doing this. Head over to hotflush.bandcamp.com and check it out. Right, on with the show. I mentioned it's the first new episode for a few weeks, and we are welcoming none other than Fracture to the show. Fracture is a bit of an underground legend of the London drum and bass scene, although as we hear during the conversation, he feels a little bit estranged from drum and bass these days. But he has been running a really interesting label for the last 15 years or so called Astrophonica. And yeah, we talk about that stuff. But also, I think more interestingly, or just as interestingly, I should probably say, we talk in general terms about the development of scenes and the state the underground, in quotation marks, music scene is in today globally. So yeah, great to have him on. Astrophonica, like I said, is a drum and bass label ostensibly, but they've moved around the edges, I think it's fair to say, of that genre. So I guess it's sort of analogous. It's sort of in the same direction, philosophically anyway, as D-Bridge's Exit Records and the Autonomic Sound and all that kind of stuff. But it's not the same thing exactly, but I guess it's coming from the same headspace as that stuff. So, I mean, they've, in addition to drum and bass stuff, they've also released some really interesting 160 BPM 4/4 stuff, which I referenced in the conversation. And yeah, it's a label which is well worth checking out, and Fracture Productions are also, generally speaking, worth checking out for sure. So yeah, great to have him on the show. Just before we get started, a reminder, you can get rid of the ads by heading to patreon.com/scubaofficial. Follow the show wherever you listen to this podcast. If you don't want to do that, it's also cool. That really does help the show too. There's a Spotify playlist you can also follow. Check the show notes for that playlist. And join us on the Discord, hotflushrecordings.com/discord. There is a private area for patrons, but you can just get into the server regardless via that link. Okay, without further delay, here is Fracture. Fracture, welcome to the show. How's it going?
I'm good, mate. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, big fan of the show. Actually, before we get started, I must say that.
Good. So glad to hear it. Well, hopefully we're going to deliver a good episode to live up to that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is actually the second time attempting this. So we were saying off mic that we were trying to figure out last time we saw each other. It can't have been 15 years ago, which was your your estimate. I can't swear it can't be that.
I think it was. Yeah, no, I think it was. I think you just moved to Berlin.
Wow.
And I think I came on essentially a raving holiday.
Shit, actually, yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I remember sitting with you in a pizza place on Warschauerstrasse in 2007. Right. Fucking hell. Okay. Well, yeah, obviously quite a lot has happened since then.
Yes.
So, yeah, tell me what's going on, man. Tell me what's going on with you guys at the moment, with the label and all that.
Yeah, man, so we're pretty busy, label side of things. I mean, we've literally just announced a new record by Sully and a vocalist called Sallow. So I get my plugs in there early. But that's like a real good example, I think, of what I've been trying to do on the label, which is present music that is familiar to people but always has asked some questions and kind of flips the expectations a little bit, I suppose. I mean, I say now, I suppose, it's primarily we release kind of jungle and drum and bass, but have been known to do all sorts of things. But I'm always quite interested in the little bits in between genres and the slightly different takes on existing genres.
Yeah, because I mean, the label it started in 2009, was it? Am I right in saying that? Yeah, and it's always, yeah, like as you said, it's kind of sat at the edge of that drum and bass thing, right? I guess in a similar kind of spot to, Exit Records sort of springs to mind, and that I guess they're kind of what people might describe as kind of left field end of drum and bass. Is that kind of how you see it?
It is, yeah, definitely. I mean, Exit has definitely been a kind of place of inspiration. And I mean, Darren and D-Bridge, and you know, everything D-Bridge does is I always take on board and I always kind of use him as a source of inspiration. So I will always give a shout out to Exit. But in terms of what I do and what we do, you know what it is, right? It's one of those ones I've never thought of it as in I'm going to release left field music. Mm. It's just the music I always gravitate towards. And I think that's how I've always A&R'd the label, is that I'm not looking for something in particular. I'm just looking for music that immediately excites me as a listener, actually, more than anything else. You know, so it's just my taste. It's just that's what my taste is. I've never set out to have any kind of mission to release specifically kind of left field or flip mode kind of versions of existing genres. But that's just where my taste gravitates towards.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure we'll probably get into this sort of stuff later on, but the moments in time that have always excited me have been like, you know, for instance, the early dubstep kind of 2005, 2006, where it wasn't quite solidified and it was, the boundaries were somewhat undefined. And then like the autonomic thing, I know you've spoken about that on the podcast before, so the kind of 2009, 2010 thing. And then like there was the Footwork Jungle thing, which was a few years after that. That's where my taste leads me to, those sort of moments in between genres where possibilities arise.
Do you find that drum and bass is, like generally speaking, is a scene which is like easy to fit those slightly different kind of curveballs into? I mean, my perception of drum and bass, I think, has always been that it's singular musically, right? It's the tempo thing. It's the kind of the ownership that people seem to feel over the music. Do you find that trying to run a label like that, and I don't, maybe that's not the right word, but like, you know, coming to drum and bass with different influences and different kind of, I mean, curveballs is the kind of word that I keep, you know, I want to use here. Like, I mean, how do you feel about drum and bass in that respect?
Yeah. Curveball, I think, is a great word. I try not to get in trouble here now. But no, I agree with you. Is it easy? No, it's not. Quite often it isn't, particularly from a kind of crowd expectation point of view.
I read you in an interview about half an hour ago talking about clearing dance floors with your like the 4/4 stuff, like the 160 4/4 stuff, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean that's quite an extreme example, but you're right. I mean, drum and bass is bound very much by a tempo, much more than a lot of the other electronic music genres. So even something like techno or house, they, you know, you've got a swing of at least 20 BPM, I think, whereas drum and bass, you've got that swing of about 5 BPM, really. As soon as you take it slower, it becomes something else. And I mean, if you want to go even faster, then, you know, that again becomes something completely different. So it is tricky, but I've always found that as a bit of a challenge and something that excites me and something that artistically inspires me. Okay, so how can I fit into the world of, let's say, drum and bass, jungle drum and bass, but present some new ideas? How can I do that? How can I have people that are into this music already also accept the slightly kind of curveball stuff that I want to try and do? So, you know, it becomes a challenge at that point, but a challenge that I've given myself and that I then feel excited about trying to complete. And I suppose it's not about forcing music on anyone because, you know, I'm primarily a DJ, and I'd never force music on people that I didn't think was going to work. But it's the same with my DJ sets as well, actually. I've always tried to present music to people with the idea of perhaps you can also fit this in. Have you thought about this music in this context? So yeah, it becomes a challenge, and it certainly is difficult. I think. But I also kind of think that that's one of the thing, one of the reasons maybe why drum and bass is still around and is still, if anything, is stronger than it probably ever has been now, is because it has quite strict rules to it, and people follow those rules quite passionately. So although, you know, sometimes that can lead to stagnation, I also think that it gives it such a solid infrastructure, I suppose is the right word, for people to sort of return back to and come back to.
Yeah, I mean, I think having rules and having constraints can, you know, actually, you know, paradoxically almost be really creatively useful. You know, sometimes you can be too free, you know, and sometimes, like, you know, pushing at the edges of something which seems really hard, seems really, you know, set in stone. Sometimes those can be the best sort of conditions for being really creative. But I mean, over the course of the last, I mean, just talking about the lifespan of a label, have there been significant changes in the way the audience, the drum bass audience and their kind of expectations, has that changed significantly, do you think, in the over the lifespan you've been running the label for?
I think it is definitely more open now, or at least it went through a period of being more open. And I would actually say that now I'm artistically and as a label, I think we're probably standing somewhere outside of the main, I don't know what you want to call it, clutches of drum and bass. I kind of think when we started the label, 2009-2010, we were sort of on the edge, but there was quite a lot of overlap. And I think what's happened now is it went through a period, I think probably 2012, when the sort of footwork kind of thing was happening, and then had artists like Machine Drum and lots of kind of stateside artists coming in and kind of shaking up the whole thing. And of course, the autonomic thing. It went for a period of being quite open, I think, then. But I almost think it's kind of split back off a bit. And I just do what I do, you know, now. That's it. I kind of do what I do now. And I really don't like to try and sort of pigeonhole and give things too much of a box. But I guess what we do fits more into a kind of jungle sort of world better than it does strict drum and bass now, I think. I mean, I hear a lot of the drum and bass I hear now. Number one, I don't know who anyone is that's making it anymore or playing it, really. And number two, it's quite far from what I'm currently doing. And that's not a comment on it creatively or musically. It's just quite far from what I'm doing currently.
Okay, so do you not really see yourself as being part of it almost anymore?
Not really, no. Not really.
Really? Wow, okay.
Not really, no. I think, and I mean, this comes with experience and longevity, I suppose. I'm quite confident in doing just what I want to do. And existing in my own place that I've sort of slowly carved out over, I mean, 20 years.
Sure. I mean,
but to go,
yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to say to go back to what you were saying about rules and genres having specific rules being a good thing. I think you're right, because it does a couple of things, right? It allows you then to be able to break those rules.
Yeah.
And that's when exciting stuff happens. So, you know, those moments that I mentioned before, you know, the autonomic, the dubstep, those kind of moments where it's like all of a sudden the rules are being broken. But also I kind of feel that if you don't have rules, or at least a set of standards by which a genre or a movement or whatever adheres to, there's almost a loss of context. And like you say, you're so free that basically you can do anything, which on paper sounds like a great idea. But if you can do anything, then there's almost no, almost like quality control, I suppose, because anything goes and anything's okay.
Right.
So it is paradoxical because on one hand, that feels great. It's like, of course, why shouldn't we artistically be able to do anything and have zero rules? But I do feel that those rules provide context. And I think context is incredibly important in any sort of art. You know, context culturally, context historically, sonically, all of those sort of things. You know, I think context is incredibly important. And if you lose that, it can ultimately just be a load of different sounds kind of thrown together rhythmically.
Yeah, I mean, particularly when you're talking about dance music, right? Because at the end of the day, like, you know, it's music which is, I mean, yeah, I'm willing to call it art, but it's functional art. You know, it's being made for a specific purpose, and you've got to, and if it doesn't meet that purpose, which is to say make people dance in a rave, then it hasn't really succeeded, has it? So yeah, I mean, exactly right. I mean, context is the right way to put it, because, you know, the context is, you know, enabling people to vibe off whatever is coming out of the speakers on a dance floor, right? And yeah, and without that, and you're kind of lost. But let me ask you, because I think we first met, I think, as a result of technicality that night in the early 2000s.
Yeah,
I think that's where we first came across each other. Well, because you were friends with Matt Qualified, and I also knew Matt.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s.
That's right.
And technicality, it struck me, was, I mean, I was trying to remember it. I only went to it a couple of times, but, you know, my perception of the kind of dance scene, that the kind of wider dance scene, and the kind of the club scene, like particularly in London, is that a lot of those small venues have been squeezed out. A lot of them don't exist anymore. And my perception is that that kind of small club, small night ecosystem has really been, I mean, I'm not going to say that it doesn't exist, but I don't think it's nothing like what it was in that era. Is that something, do you agree with that statement?
Yeah, it's a tough one, man. I mean, that was an incredible period of time, early 2000s, East London, mainly Shoreditch. I mean, there seemed like there was, on any given night of the week, there'd be like three or four really cool things going on in Shoreditch, be it at Plastic People or Herbal, or I mean, there were loads. It felt like there were loads of little kind of venues popping up and allowing people space to do things. Yeah, I do think it's changed. And I think I was getting excited again in like 2019, actually. And it seemed like through people like Sherelle and a Six-Figure Gang, as they were at the time, and that sort of little movement, it kind of felt like there were little things going on again, which unfortunately got kind of scuppered by COVID. And then post-COVID, if I'm honest, the whole thing just feels completely different. Even I feel different mentally about where I am and where I sit in it, and how I relate to it. You know, the fact is, I'm not at a period in my life where I'm going out to sort of small weekday nights anymore. You know, I've got two kids. And so my life is different, you know? So yeah, the whole thing feels different. I think for me, the biggest change and the biggest loss is obviously the spaces themselves, but it's what those spaces allowed. And that was like an incubation period of ideas and scenes, like going back to Forward at Plastic
People. Yeah, I was absolutely part of the same thing, right? Totally.
I mean, some weeks I remember going there, it'd be like 10 people there.
Yeah, literally,
like, literally,
right? Yeah.
10 people.
Yeah,
and that went on for months at a time, you know, and that was just kind of the thing. Are you going Forward this week? Yeah, maybe there's 10 people, maybe there's 20, maybe there's 30, maybe it's packed. And I think technicality at Herbal was the same. You know, some months were quiet, other months were really busy. But what that allowed allowed the music to do, and most important, the crews of people to do, was kind of really incubate and build something. And that is something that I feel is like a real shame that doesn't necessarily exist in the same way. Kind of feel like particularly in London, it's very competitive. And if you don't kind of start off with a real banger of a night, you know, you risk just not being invited back, or not even having the finances to continue, you know. So yeah, it is in a different place, and it is a bit of a shame. But at the same time, I will say that I'm post COVID, I feel that, you know, I do feel a little bit more of a disconnect anyway. So there might be stuff going on that I'm not necessarily aware of.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm loath to make absolute statements about this stuff. Yeah, for exactly the same reasons that you've just given too. But I think that. I mean, what you say about there being like immediate financial pressure in a way that there wasn't before, I mean, that really, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because, I mean, I think there's financial pressure at all levels, you know, for, I mean, anyone involved in this industry, really, particularly that part of the industry. And I think small venues must be under the most pressure of everyone, right? Just because of the, you know, just because of the obvious, like the costs that have gone up so much, and particularly post-COVID. And, you know, I think that has a tangible benefit, because, I mean, you know, I think using those examples of Technicality and Forwards, if they'd been under pressure to shift hard tickets, they wouldn't have survived. They just wouldn't have, right?
Yeah. Yeah, totally not. Completely. They totally wouldn't have. And it gives a different purpose for the night as well. Then, like you say, it's not a hard ticket situation.
Yeah,
it's more of a, it becomes almost like a testing ground sort of thing. I mean, and you know, Technicality and Forward and loads of other nights were like that. They became sort of testing grounds. Again, you know, Darren and Exit Records, they had quite a few little bits and bobs along the way in East London as well, and that was always the idea there. It was like, let's test some music. Let's test some new ideas. Mm. And those always feel the most exciting spaces for me. I know we'll keep going on about it, but Forward, those early kind of Forward years, when it was kind of dubstep, not quite. There was also a lot of grime being played. I mean, that was just like, I found that so exciting as a listener, because I had no idea what...
Yeah, it was music you couldn't hear anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you said, you had no idea what was going to be played, and it was music that was only going to be played there, right?
Yeah, or on pirate radio.
Yeah.
Those were the two places. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, because it's different though, isn't it? It's fundamentally different playing stuff on the radio compared to playing stuff in front of an audience, right? And I think it's the same... Well, I think this is the problem now, because, I mean, yeah, there's plenty of opportunity to people to play music, you know, because... you know, online and on, you know, there's no shortage of streams and all the rest of it. But in a club with a big sound system, with people on the floor, that's when you really find out about a tune, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And sometimes that doesn't happen immediately either.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very keen to not sort of... dump on how the culture moves and exists currently. You know, the sort of immediate impact of social media and the seemingly throwaway nature of it. But it's something one of your other guests has said, actually, Crust. I can't remember if he said it on your podcast or if he said it elsewhere, but he talks about how arguably his biggest tune, Warhead, I think he had it on dub for like 18 months.
Mm.
And for the first kind of 6 to 9 months of those or whatever it was, no one was really reacting to it in a club.
Yeah.
And if anything, people were reacting badly to it.
It's crazy that, isn't it? Just it just seems so ridiculous. But, you know, sometimes it's just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas now it kind of very much feels like, and it can be really disheartening and derailing, and that's why I think it's dangerous. It can feel like, oh, you finish something, you play it out, doesn't get the immediate reaction. So then that's kind of that. That's the end of that life cycle of that piece of music. Whereas those spaces like Technicality, Forward and whatnot, you know, they gave those reoccurring nights, they gave the space for people to get into the music slowly.
Mm.
And then suddenly think like, right, I kind of get what's going on here. rather than, okay, it gets dropped, didn't get the reaction, scrap that one, try something else.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting you say that, because you're right to say that there was a lot of grime played at the early forward. But I think actually that happened was the reason that they started getting the MCs down, right, the reason they started booking some of the grime guys was because the early dubstep stuff wasn't really connecting and it wasn't getting people dancing enough. That's the impression I think I have looking at it now anyway.
Right.
But then ultimately, the stuff, when it really did, you know, pick up, actually that wasn't a great moment for grime. Like 2006, 2007, that wasn't great. Those weren't great years for grime. And it was just suddenly the wind went into the sails of that dubstep stuff and it just, you know, but that wouldn't have happened. That wouldn't have survived without, as you're describing, you know, the space being there, you know, for the experimentation to happen and, you know, the different things to different influences to come into it, you know? And that's, yeah, I guess, the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I'm interested in hearing how you approach this, because the music I've always been into, be it jungle, be it dubstep, be it the footwork jungle kind of stuff, it was always really new and cutting edge and fresh, right? So I've always been like someone who looks forward. But now we're at a point where there are a lot of discussions about how it used to be, so how it was forward, how it was pre-social media, right? So how do you approach that as a concept? Like, because I always want to be on the cutting edge of things, and I'm always interested in what young people are doing, and I'm always interested in how young people are making music, why they're making music, and so on. And I really don't want to be the kind of older guy who's like, oh, you know, we should have done it this way, better this way, because I was... you know, I was always interested in what was happening on the forefront of technology and culture and all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to ask you a question. How do you approach that as a concept?
I mean, I think it's really hard. I think particularly in the last few years, not a lot new has really happened in electronic music at all, really. I mean, it's difficult to reach a different conclusion than that. Because I mean, when you talk about something like footwork was just completely out of the left field. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, I mean, I don't think anyone saw that coming, you know, something which would be so completely almost alien sounding. But then to have a really, like, an interesting set of influences on stuff which was happening and stuff which was popular, right? But that was like, that's 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, that really sort of caught on and started to have an impact. And I don't know, I mean, It's difficult not to be pessimistic about it, and it's difficult not to have these sorts of conversations with the caveat that there is, of course, lots of great music being made at any given point. And, you know, I relatively recently started doing a radio show again, which has, you know, kind of focused my mind in searching out new music each month, and there are loads of great tunes coming out, but I don't see there being like movements in that kind of a sense, you know, like, so in isolation, there's tons of great producers making great stuff, some of which is really quite interesting, but there aren't those, you know, little scenes which bubble up and then really catch momentum and suddenly you've got a whole kind of musical movement of the sort that you had in multiple instances, I guess. For, you know, you could talk about going back to the, you know, to Acid House, you know, like from that period, like, say, mid-80s up to probably about 10 years ago, there was just a kind of seemingly a constant conveyor belt of these, just as I described, just fresh musical movements which would, you know, which seemingly come from nowhere and take influence from various different other things but make something which seemed tangibly new. I don't know, and it's really difficult, like you say, because you don't want to be that, you know, old guy and trying to be objective about it and trying to see things for as they are. But it's difficult to reach a different conclusion, I think. I really think it is.
It is difficult, man. It is very difficult. And I think over that time period that you mentioned, you know, Acid House, and from then all these kind of rapid, really new musical expressions, they were quite often, or almost always, the result of some sort of new technology, right? Some kind of new studio or music tech, be it the sampler or I'm trying to think now, or Drum Machine, or, you know, those were kind of like really kind of landmark changes in music technology. And then even like
plugins becoming widely available and cheap, that had a huge impact on music, you know.
Yeah, and I just don't think there hasn't been anything for a while now, probably over 10 years, if not longer than that, maybe even since the DAW. Now it feels like everything is just like an iteration and a more convenient, quicker, bigger hard drive version of what's existed already.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I have made this exact observation. I think you're absolutely right. Like, it's seemingly up until the advent of the door in its kind of modern sense, which was basically 20 years ago at this point, or maybe more. Like every technological innovation since then has really just been about making it easier to do stuff which you could do before.
Yeah.
Whereas before that, like probably the 50 years or more of, you know, music tech developments from, like, you know, the electric guitar to whatever, those were primarily around making new sounds, right? They were about making something which sounded different.
Yeah.
And everything we've had in recent memory has really just been about making something which has happened before, but just making it easier for people to do the same stuff.
Yeah,
basically, which is a bit of a caricature, but I think that's broadly speaking pretty accurate.
Yeah, no, totally. I think it's important to kind of say that. Yeah, this is not an absolute opinion. This is just a kind of take, I think, on where we're at the moment. I mean, so then it becomes about, okay, so then what does inspire change in electronic music? Where do you get new inspiration from? It's not going to be like the Akai time stretch, you know, which went on and it inspired loads of producers to do that. Or it's not going to be like maybe the 303 or something like that. Because of everything we've just discussed, then it's about what are we using as these next sources of inspiration, these next points of inspiration? And it's a hard question to answer, man. It's a really hard question to answer. I think for me, like mixing genres together, mixing pre-existing ideas together, I think has always and can continue to be a source of inspiration. So, you know, like the footwork and the jungle sort of thing, that was post any interesting technology happening, and there wasn't any kind of interesting technology that allowed that to happen. That was just taking two different genres from two different places and two different, culturally quite different as well, and sort of putting them together and seeing what came out of it. And then I think in 2019, just before COVID, I was playing a lot of electro and mixing that in with a lot of breakbeat stuff, or break stuff that had breakbeats in it. So, you know, 140 BPM jungle tracks and then mixing electro in. And then all of a sudden that was like, oh, that feels quite interesting. What happens if we have kind of loads of techie electro-y kind of drum sounds with some jungle breaks and stuff like that? And then that kind of immediately felt interesting and new. So I think you know, the technology thing is really important, really, 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 really important. And it's an important way of understanding how music is going to change going forward, because it can ultimately stop you having the internal conversation or the rhetoric of like, oh, there's nothing new happens anymore. Nothing, you know, we're all just rehashing the same ideas. When it's like, yes, we are. But that's because there isn't any new technology that is going to drastically change the way in which we make music or provide us with new sounds. Even the topic that you spoke about quite a few times on this podcast, the AI thing.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, yeah.
I don't actually think that's necessarily going to offer any new sounds or new... I mean, I might be totally wrong here, and I hope I am, but I can't see how it's going to offer anything that we haven't necessarily already heard. And I mean, by definition, at this point at least, it's just sort of recreating examples of existing material anyway.
Yeah,
I'm not a massive AI. I'm not a massive AI guy at all. So, you know, I might get shot down for a lot of this. This is just my kind of very kind of uneducated take on it. But to me, it doesn't feel like that's going to provide us with any immediate change to the sonics of dance music.
Sure, I think I guess the response to that would be that. You know, AI is essentially a tool, and it still would rely upon whichever human, whichever artist is using that tool to identify whatever's coming out of the whatever AI plugin or whatever, you know, whatever's being used. There's still got to be a human to identify that and say, yeah, that sounds sick, that sounds different, I'm going to release that on a record. Mm. You know, so it's not just a case of, you know, AI coming up with something which is cool. It's got to be, you know, someone's got to vibe with it in the immediate term. And then it's got to migrate, you know, it's got to make its way from, you know, from the producer to the label to, you know, dub play or whatever, you know, to use a archaic term. But you know what I mean? Yeah. It's got to, like, there's still a way to go, I guess is what I'm saying. Because, I mean, as I said before, I think there are really great records being made. I think what we're lacking is a bit of cohesion and a bit of kind of community.
Yeah.
I think, if anything, that's maybe the bigger problem. And to go back to what I was saying before about the, you know, small venues being squeezed and, you know, there just not being the opportunity for these things to incubate in their natural habitat, if you want. Mm-hmm. Like, I think maybe that's the bigger problem here. I mean, obviously they're aggravating factors, but like I'm trying to compare it to, you know, those kind of early 2000s kind of days, which were so exciting. I think without those clubs, it wouldn't have been the same thing.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
No, it certainly wouldn't have. It certainly wouldn't have. So then it becomes about how do you provide that possibility for incubation in today's cultural climate. Also, with deep consideration of young people, because that's the other thing to really remember here, right? That dance music, electronic music, at least the stuff that we're primarily interested in or kind of leaning towards, is all made by young people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, almost all good music, generally speaking, is made by young people. Let's face it, you know.
Exactly. So. Ultimately, it's down to them not to pass the buck to
come
them.
Come on, young people, come up with some good tunes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not just come up with good tunes. It's kind of like come up with a way of how you can incubate and grow on a long-term level, how you can grow something, how you can grow ideas, and how you can bounce off of each other and learn from each other to give yourself a scene, the kind of infrastructure that will allow it to be there for years and years and years to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, all the flip mode is there, that maybe we are so in such a different place culturally that that's just not going to happen, and maybe even that looking at it and considering it from that point of view is now antiquated.
Yeah, I mean, I think culture reflects the kind of physical like surroundings, like to a certain extent anyway. And I think, you know, we were talking about, you know, about the pressure on small venues and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's not a cultural thing. It's an economic reality, right? And I think culture has basically evolved to fit that economic reality in a way which I think has been quite bad for small music scenes. I mean, just objectively, I think that's probably accurate. And you know, what has replaced it has been, the way people meet and the way people interact is online now, obviously, to a much greater extent. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, social media is, and increasingly just TikTok is the kind of dominant sphere there. And let me ask you about, in terms of how you guys run the label, like, do you take TikTok and that kind of thing seriously at all? In terms of, do you, for example, do like TikTok edits and that kind of shit? Is that part of your thinking with the label?
No.
Fair enough.
No, initially. Yeah, let me just think about this, because it's a really interesting question. And I think it's changing constantly as well, my opinion on it. Okay, so I'll tell you what, right? I'll tell you who is excellent, is Elijah.
Right.
Who I'm sure you've seen.
Yeah, he's been on the podcast, yeah.
And his yellow squares and whatnot. And his, so when I hear him talking about social media, I'm like, yeah, this sounds incredible. I want in on this. And how can I adapt what I'm doing? And how can I use it, as he says, as a canvas? But then when I try to kind of put it into practice, it feels... It can start to feel a bit forced and a bit ultimately unnatural. And I think where we've got the label, where we built the label, is to a really good place, and we've got a really dedicated fan base to which I'm always indebted to. You know, like I'm always just amazed by how dedicated the fan base to our label is, and we've sort of built that up. All in using our own channels. Like, obviously, I use social media. Like, I use it. You know, I have an Instagram and a Twitter and whatnot. But I don't use TikTok. But I'm also interested in how it works and why it works. Because as I said, I am interested in culture, and I'm interested in cutting edge culture. And you know, off the back of how excited I was about jungle music, about dubstep and whatnot, I'm always interested in what young people are doing and what they're excited about and how they approach things. So I always do have one eye on it, yeah. But I think the way I've run the label from an AR perspective, and for want of a better word, a branding perspective, even though that doesn't at all fit kind of my outlook, it's always been authentic. It's always been about authenticity. And you know, not from a point of view as in like, what can I do that feels authentic? It's just how I do it. That's just kind of what naturally happens. It's all about my taste. It's all about my A&R. It's all about me hearing the music I want to hear and releasing the music I want to hear. So anything I do on social media has to also fit that, I think. And unfortunately, I think a lot of what I'm seeing currently in terms of music promotion on social media doesn't feel authentic.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at with it at the moment.
Can you be, let me ask you about that. Can you be more specific about that? Do you mean, when you're seeing other people promote other labels, or is it a case of artists promoting themselves. I mean, that's the thing with social media. It's like, I think it's kind of an uneasy fit when you're trying to, we talk from the perspective of the traditional record label.
Yeah.
It's tough to put, to make that into something, into a social media presence that makes any kind of sense. But is that what you mean by that?
I think I've just, let me try and word this correctly. Again, going back to what Elijah says, there's social media and using it as a canvas and genuinely tying it in with what you do and your brand and making interesting stuff. And then there is the posting of stuff designed to just get likes or to go viral,
right,
or whatever. You know, that feels uncomfortable for me. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword one. I don't know if that's the right term, but, you know, I look at what some people do on it and I'm like, that just feels so you. It feels right, what you're doing. And then there's a lot of other stuff on there that I'm just like, this feels just kind of like trying to game an algorithm or, you know, that kind of stuff. But then it is a real tricky one, because then why not, right? Why not? The social media is a platform. It's just another tool. It's just there. If you're making cool music, good art, why would you not want as many people to see or hear that as possible? And if that means doing things in order to appease the algorithm, then why would you not do that? So that's what I mean by I have a kind of complex understanding and relationship, I think, with social media at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to be cynical about it. You know, it's so easy to look at it in a kind of reflexively negative kind of a way, right? Because like you say, like, it's, I mean, I think it's, you know, you've any kind of scroll down Instagram or whatever, like, you're 100% of the time going to see people doing exactly what you described. I mean, doing stuff which is the most, I guess, bad faith kind of interaction, just trying in a really naked kind of a way to, as you said, like, game the algorithm and just get likes, and it just leaves a bad taste in the mouth. And it's so easy just to come across those kinds of things and just think, what's the world come to? But, like,
yeah,
as you say, at the end of the day, it is just a tool. So
it's a tool. So why should we not use it? Why should we not use it? You know, the marketing of music is not a new thing, right?
That's the thing. Okay, so there was a viral, there was a post that went viral a couple of weeks ago. It was this female musician basically talking about how embarrassing it is to promote your music online. And, and she used the example of, Tom York would never have done this, when Radiohead was starting out. But obviously that's not true, because Radiohead very famously, had a toe-curlingly embarrassing marketing campaign for the Creep single, right? It's just a different kind of marketing. It was just the marketing of the early 90s and the marketing of the 2020s.
Yeah.
You know, this stuff has always existed. There's always been embarrassing shit to have to go through to market a record. I mean, it's just always been like that,
yeah,
you know? And it just feels more embarrassing now, I suppose. Maybe because social media feels more personal. Right, because it is your account, and people have the perception that it is you're going to be doing it, and it's like, you're sitting there with your phone, and maybe that does feel a little bit more embarrassing. But really, this shit's always been part of music, right?
Yeah, it has been. And like I said before, like, why would you not want as many people to find your music as possible? Like, is that not the sort of,
yeah?
I'm not going to say that's the aim, right? The aim is to make amazing music that you feel strongly about and you love. But once you've done that...
Yeah, of course you want as many people as possible to hear it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's a tricky one. So off the back of all of that, yes, I do use social media and I will continue to. But it's not something that we build into like a release campaign or something like that. You know, it's pretty kind of it's a pretty kind of standard approach to it.
Mm.
But that's not to say that it's not a space that you can do some fun stuff on.
Yeah, no, I mean, the reason, one of the reasons I asked the question is because, you may have seen this news story last week with Universal and TikTok beefing, and our labels distributed by Universal, and all our music disappeared from TikTok the next day, and suddenly you're into the kind of front line of these, you know, major kind of music industry wars, and you realize how important that platform is now. It's crazy. In a few short years, you know, that's really become a very, very significant thing in music as a whole, and maybe not so much in the kind of music, the area of music that we operate in, as you said. Like it is a bit of a kind of silo, but you know, it's the pace of change is really not letting up. You know, I think there was a kind of assumption once streaming had established itself that was kind of going to be it now, but like it's seemingly there is another front opening, you know, in the whole thing. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, so actually that's a separate question. In the period that you guys have been running Astrophonica, that was the period of streaming becoming dominant. So how did you guys deal with that I guess it was the first sort of 5 or 6 years of a label was when, maybe a bit longer than that, as streaming became more important. How did you guys figure your way through that transition?
Yeah. So I'm just trying to plot the timeline. So yeah, we started it in like 2008 or 2009. And at that point, I don't think streaming was even a thing at all, if I'm right. And I don't even think buying digital was really a thing at that point either. I think maybe there was iTunes.
Yeah.
So at that point, we were just selling vinyl. And that went on for a couple of years. Then the selling of digital started up. And at that point, we were with ST Holdings. And
I'm hopefully going to have Chris Parkinson on the show at some stage, hopefully.
Yeah, shout out Chris, man. And they had the Surus thing. Do you remember Surus?
Yeah. They tried to build their own platform and just emptied a load of resources into it, and unfortunately never really came to fruition.
It was kind of like a Bandcamp. It was sort of like, the idea was kind of like a Bandcamp thing. And
it was a great idea, to be fair.
They run. It was a wicked idea. Yeah, it was a great idea. And it actually worked for us for a little bit. And I remember, Chris saying, like, look, let's give away the MP3 with every vinyl purchase. And I remember for ages, I was just like, I can't get my head around that.
Right.
I was just like, what, you want me to give an MP3 away with every vinyl purchase? I was just like, I can't get my head around that. But obviously, you know, that's now what everyone does on Bandcamp. But I remember specifically being like, oh, that's just bizarre, man. That's weird. And then streaming came along and I sort of fumbled through it for a bit. And I've got to give a massive shout out to Mark Shelley, who you might know.
No, I don't know him actually.
He basically does the back end of Astrophonica, has been doing it for probably about 10 years now. Distribution, manufacture, and is now taking on a lot of other labels as well as sequences. Mm. And he has really been a huge help in kind of getting on top of streaming and everything like that, and got the label to a point where it's definitely another revenue source. Yeah, 100%. 100%. I would say it's a funny one, isn't it? It's like, I know there's a lot of people taking music off streaming at the moment, and I'm always wary about if that would actually boost your Bandcamp or your direct downloads.
Yeah, I'm pretty dubious.
Because I see it as kind of two different markets. I don't know. Like I said, could be proven wrong there. But that's kind of how we've dealt with streaming. And honestly, Mark has been like a huge help, and he's definitely got the label and the artist on the label, and myself as an artist as well, to a place where it is definitely part of the revenue. One of the revenue streams, which has any kind of small independent label, independent artist, you know, that's what it's all about, right? It's all about the different streams.
Yes.
You've talked at length on here about Bandcamp and what did you call it? Single point of failure.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it sort of kind of touches on that as a conversation where you, as a small independent artist, you have, you know, some artists, labels do better on different platforms, but ultimately you kind of got to maximize and work all of these different platforms and different streams. So whereas I've obviously got my reservations about streaming and the culture that it promotes, it's another tool. It's not going anywhere.
Mm.
And as it currently stands, it's another way for us to reach more people and another part of the stream, revenue stream. So, yeah, that's kind of my approach.
Did you guys ever do anything with NFTs?
No.
Because that's another one.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. And it's honestly something I don't know that much about. Yeah, it's still kind of... boggles me slightly, to be honest. The Web3 and the NFT thing. I know that Crust and D-Bridge and people are quite into it, but for me personally, no, I didn't.
Yeah,
I didn't ever get into it. No,
fair enough. I mean, it's pretty impenetrable, I think, conceptually, to a large extent. Yeah. Okay, I wanted to go all the way back and ask you about how you got to Technicality in the first place. Like, where were you? Where were your first raving experiences?
So going all the way back, I mean, I got into the music really young. So I grew up in East London in Hackney, and I went to school in Islington. Shout out Islington Green. And during that period, that was like started in 91. I think I started at secondary school. So the whole underground rave thing was just becoming apparent. And it was sort of everywhere in London. You couldn't escape it, particularly going to like an inner London school. There'd be people there whose brothers were maybe DJs, producers, or even going to raves or whatever. Pirate radio obviously was everywhere. I remember talking to someone just the other day about how, like, even at school on the desks, pirate radio frequencies and phone numbers would be written on the desks and stuff. And, you know, that's when I was like 13 sort of years old. So it was really like pirate radio and just being in the vicinity of basically hardcore and early jungle music that gave me my kind of first insights into it. So it was by location, really. It was by location. And then, I mean, pirate radio was my fascination and still is now. I'm working on an ongoing project called 0860 at the moment, which is a celebration of pirate radio and an archival project.
Okay. Tell me more about that. Tell me more about that, if you can.
So, yeah, no, of course I will. I'd love to. It was one of those lockdown projects, started in lockdown, gave me the space to do stuff that maybe wasn't going to work in a club. And it started out as an album, and it is an album. And I'll take it right back to kind of how it started. I found a sample of Eastman from Cool FM mentioning the classic phone, the Cool FM phone line number, 0860395262. And I thought, I'll sample that, man. That is an incredible sample. I'll make a jungle track and I'll put that in it. And the whole thing kind of snowballed from there. And then I was like, oh, this feels really interesting. It's jungle music, traditional jungle music, where it's tapping now directly into my, why I'm fascinated with jungle music. So I made an album based on pirate radio, based on what I was hearing on pirate radio, loads of samples off of pirate radio, presented it in a sort of aesthetic that was, inspired by pirate radio, so a bit more crusty, a bit more degraded, a bit more lo-fi. And then off the back of that, I thought, well, this is actually really interesting, so I'm going to expand it. And so I started interviewing people who had a background in pirate radio, so people from Cool FM like Eastman and Brian G, people from Pulse FM, people that went on to have that used pirate radio as a stepping stone to go on and have national radio careers, like DJ Flight. I spoke to Sherelle and Naina because I was interested in how young people look at the legacy of pirate radio. And I think I did it for two reasons. Number one is where I come from. It's what I'm passionate about. So I wanted to present my music and my story as an artist. But also through doing that, I became closer to how important pirate radio was to underpinning the genres that we love. So hardcore, jungle, dubstep, grime. I think dubstep and grime being the last kind of genres that probably used pirate radio as a means of, well, quite literally broadcasting their music. And then I realised it was about community as well, and I realised there was so much DIY going on in there as well, and I realised it wasn't to do with major labels, it wasn't to do with on some level it wasn't even to do with selling records or having careers as touring DJs. It was much more of a community based concept, the idea of pirate radio. So I felt that was important to document and discuss and present to people, because there's a lot of people involved in pirate radio that didn't go on to become touring DJs and big artists and whatnot, but are perhaps as important, if not more important, than some of the artists themselves. I don't know, maybe that's debatable, but you know, so people like Eastman at Cool FM, Cool FM was number one source of jungle music and jungle music information on a street level, which was the only level, for about 5 years, maybe, between the years of kind of when it started, 91, up until, I guess, probably the end of the 90s, really, you know? And if it wasn't for stations like Cool FM, I wouldn't have heard the music. But also hundreds, thousands of other people also would not have heard the music. So I thought it was incredibly important to document that and present it to people, both old and young, I think, because like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's easy to present this stuff from the point of view of like, look how amazing it used to be.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to talk to people like Sherelle and discuss it from a community point of view, and then have those questions we were having earlier on. Well, you know, what does community look like to you, and how do you share your music? How do you listen to your music? What are your kind of platforms? So yeah, that was the 0860 project. It's still ongoing now. I'm going to start it up again, as you know, doing interviews and podcasts and stuff like that, they take up a lot of time. So I'm doing it all off my own back in a kind of very, very kind of traditional pirate radio sort of way. So, yeah, so I need to find time to kind of kick that back up as and when. But that's where I come from. So that's where I come from, pirate radio.
I interrupted you, yeah. Yep.
No, it's good, man. I'm happy to talk about that stuff because I think it's important, and I think it does link to what we were talking about earlier, you know, the spaces that allow music to incubate. And pirate radio was another one of those spaces. Totally was one of those spaces. So via pirate radio, I heard all the music, and then I wanted in on jungle, but I was still too young. So I ended up going primarily to like hardcore raves, happy hardcore raves, and quite often like psytrance raves as well, because they would
We were talking about Megachipolis, weren't we? Sorry to interrupt you again, but
were.
Okay.
Yeah. Quite often they'd have like a room two, which would be jungle or happy hardcore, and then within the happy hardcore sets they'd be playing jungle. So it'd be like stuff like Chrome and Time Slammer. All the kind of early slamming vinyl stuff, where it was like a little bit jungle, a little bit happy hardcore.
Yep.
So it was like, yeah, as you mentioned, like Megatripolis at Heaven was one of the early ones I used to go to. I used to go to Labyrinth quite a lot because that actually was one that I could get
into.
Yeah,
shit.
When I was like 15.
On Dalston Lane, right? Yeah.
Yeah, on Dalston Lane.
Dalston was a bit different in those days.
I mean, yeah, the whole thing was different. I mean, and this is another kind of, I don't know, paradox of how I look back on things, right? Because Labyrinth, particularly, I used to go there, sometimes on my own to meet other people in there, sometimes with other people, but quite often, or more often than not, would get mugged in the queue, get stuff taken off you, not that I had anything to take back when I was then, and then I would just still continue to queue up and go into the club. And then, you know, similar things would happen in the club as well.
Yeah, I mean, the raves in those days were, you know, they were rough places to be. But that was part of the attraction, right?
It was part of the attraction. And this is where it is a real kind of weird relationship in my head, because I've got young kids and, you know, they might get into raves. And if you asked me, would I want them to, you know, be getting mugged in the queue going to Labyrinth? No, I wouldn't at all. But I look back on it and it made the whole thing a bit more exciting. And that sounds really weird.
No, but it did.
It felt lawless. It felt lawless. It felt alternative. It felt counterculture. It felt anti-establishment. It felt punk.
Yeah.
And that was what was super exciting about it for me, I think. Yeah. So yeah, like Labyrinth was definitely early days Labyrinth, and then I started going to the bigger events. When I could finally get in to events, I started going to things like World Dance and bigger event Desire. Mm. What's the other one still going now? Mickey Finn's thing. Is it Mickey Finn? Innovation. All those kind of stuff. Yeah, Camden Palace, all that sort of stuff. And then it was like Bar Rumba. Movement at Bar Rumba,
yeah,
and stuff like that. And then I was in, and it was just wherever.
Yeah. So, who is your favorite DJ when you were a kid?
Good question, man. When I was listening to pirate radio, it was probably Brocky,
right?
On Cool FM, you know, Brocky and Det. It just sort of doesn't get more iconic
yeah,
than that
absolutely,
if you're sort of talking
man.
about jungle music. So yeah, Brocky and Det, and then like Andy C, I think, as a club DJ, was always one of my favourites. Just like incredible mixing capability, incredible selection, but also just an amazing DJ.
Yeah.
So I think radio wise, it would have been Brocky, but I was also a massive fan of Brian G. on Cool FM as well, because he did like a Sunday night show. This was kind of, I would say this was like mid-90s, 96-ish, and he was like the dub plate guy, right? So if there was a big tune, Brian G would have cut it. So he became a place on Sunday nights that you would hear like all the new dubs that weren't going to be coming out for sort of 18 months. And the way in which he presented his show, he did quite a lot of talking about the music that he played. That was quite different for pirate radio, because quite often pirate radio was a DJ and an MC, and it was just kind of like almost like an extension of a club set. Whereas Brian G was much more of a kind of radio presenter. So, you know, all these little moments along the way that just kind of deepened my sort of fascination and love for it, really.
Yeah. And when did you start DJing?
I mean, technicality and stuff like that. That was when I would say I really started playing out. Mm. So that was like 2001, was it? 2001, 2002?
Something like that, yeah.
Previous to that, I started on Rude FM in about 99. And then previous to that, it was pretty much just playing in my bedroom.
How did you get on Rude in the first place? How did you get your first... set on pirate?
Yeah, I mean, same way a lot of people do. I think they used to have adverts. If you know, if you listen to a lot of pirate radio archive material, you know that they have an ad break every 2 hours or every hour. And in that ad break, there's quite often a little infomercial, or whatever you want to call it, at the end, saying if you want to, if you want to get on the station, send us a tape to this PO box. So yeah, that's what I did.
Right. Wow.
And you had to kind of like send in a little tape with a you presenting it as if it would be your, you know, this is how I'd present my show. And then went and met them outside some pub somewhere. I can't even remember where it was now. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a real culture, isn't it? And it's funny because when you said that dubstep and grime is really kind of the last genres of that sort of underground music to really kind of come about as a result of that pirate culture, that, yeah, I mean, that makes makes a lot of sense that there has been no equivalent really since. Because, yeah, when we're talking about footwork, like footwork came from the States, basically, and it came via the internet, basically. Mm-hmm. But there hasn't been, you know, the hardcore continuum, as it were, kind of came to a stop, didn't it, really?
Yeah.
And the hardcore continuum was basically a pirate radio-driven thing, wasn't it? I think, broadly speaking.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And it wasn't until I really started getting, like, digging into this as a project that I really sort of realised that.
Mm.
And it's because hardcore continuum, all of that sort of stuff, acid house, rave music, it's all anti-establishment, right? Whether it's actively anti-establishment or not, right? It's counterculture and it's anti-establishment and it's DIY. And it quite often benefits from the misuse of existing equipment or existing locations or so on. And pirate radio fit perfectly into that as well. So, yeah, so then it's about, well, where are those spaces now, as we've mentioned? And I think there's quite a strong illegal party scene in London.
Mm.
With young people, again, this is now slightly out of my jurisdiction these days. But I think there's quite a strong illegal party scene in London. But, you know, on the flip side to that, the police have such powers now that I think they can just shut you down before you've even started a party. I don't know what the laws are exactly, but it's not like it was previously, you know, previous to kind of 1994. If you'd set up and you were partying, there was nothing the police could do. And it wasn't until the criminal justice...
I mean, it's pretty crazy that it was like that, wasn't it? I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, there's, you know, there's the stories about Spiral Tribe, but was it Castle
Morton?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Which was like a two-week rave in a field.
Jesus. I mean...
People living there
sounds
and
like
stuff.
Hard work, to be honest. But
yeah. So yeah. I think that's why the hardcore continuum somewhat has slowed down, and people are looking to the hardcore continuum for inspiration.
Yeah,
because I think it's really hard to have a counterculture these days. Like, what even is counterculture these days?
Yeah, this is a question that's been asked on the show more than once, and there isn't an easy answer to it, to be honest, because I think one of the things that really has happened, I think one of the major things that happened in the 90s was the brands, big kind of fashion brands, but also just, you know, anything that had an eye, any company that had an eye on marketing to young people, just got into the habit of latching on to any cultural trends that seemed like it was cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's another thing that we talked about on the show a lot as well, is the degree to which people are okay with brands being involved with things now in a way which is not so much the case in the kind of early few years of the kind of post acid house rave scene or even the club scene or whatever. Like, that's another, I think, sort of aggravating factor, because I think, like, there is no counterculture. Everything is just culture, right? And because, you know, there is such a degree of fragmentation and co-option of anything, like I said, that seems to emerge, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the same thing happened with skateboarding.
Yep.
I was a kind of avid skater in the kind of early to mid 90s. I was never very good, but I was definitely kind of fascinated by the culture. I used to go to South Bank quite a lot. And again, much like Labyrinth, you'd get your board taken off you quite often. And just generally, it was a very unpoliced sort of place. It's still there, but like you say, brands are involved and skating became a fashion statement as opposed to, or not as opposed to, but it became more of a fashion statement for people rather than something that they'd actually dedicate their life to. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think maybe graffiti is still, you know, due to its sort of illegal nature, I think there is still presents itself as a bit of a counterculture. I think aesthetically, brands have jumped on it, and it's been accepted into kind of the wider culture from a sort of aesthetic or purely visual point of view. But I think culturally, I think it's still one of the last sort of true widespread countercultures, I think. I don't know. I would love to. I'm saying this very much from a point of view of being like a bit of a blinkered sort of electronic musician from London. I'd like to hear. I mean, what's the punk scene like? Is there a punk scene? Is that still a thing?
Yeah. I mean, that's.
Are they worried? Are they kind of worried about social media and streaming numbers and stuff like that?
I think they definitely are. I think they definitely are. I mean. That's the thing. That's what's so interesting about music, the kind of global music scene, as it were, the global music market, the global music industry now. What is so interesting about it is there are unbelievably successful musicians that no one's ever heard of. Like, you know, musicians who, by any stretch of the imagination, are, you know, very, very popular. You know, but the fragmentation of music scenes has become such that, you know, it's possible to be command of a really quite a big audience and do millions and millions of streams and probably just make a living out of streaming. But no one outside of your immediate audience has heard of you. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about it. I mean, there's so few genuinely global stars. I mean, like, you know, Taylor Swift kind of takes all the headlines because she is, I think, even in the context of historical, you know, global pop stars, she is a huge global pop star. But, you know, there just aren't, there just isn't that kind of commonality of experience with music now. At a wide level. But I think that's also true for, you know, as you kind of drill down into more quote unquote underground scenes, there's just such a volume of things happening that it's impossible to keep, it's impossible to have any kind of like, you know, comprehensive view about all of it, you know, and that's why when I'm kind of having this kind of conversation, I'm kind of bemoaning, you know, how bad things are. At the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, no, but there has to be something amazing happening somewhere, just because there must be, right? Like, and I don't think you could say that 30 years ago, because I just don't think there was that kind of plurality of people just doing stuff, and you know, there wasn't the ability for as many people to, you know, Ableton has just meant that, you know, literally billions of people could be making music at any given time, and that sort of by definition means that something somewhere must be good, right?
Yeah, but then you know, what do you judge? How do you judge good, right?
Well, yeah.
For me, it kind of goes back again to what we were saying at the beginning. It's all contextual. I know that sounds weird, because then that's kind of suggests that something can be good in one context but not in another context. Then it all kind of gets a bit confused. But I think that the context is everything, and isolated incidents of things being good, whatever that means, I just don't think it's a drop in the ocean, isn't it? It doesn't travel.
Yeah, but that doesn't make a movement, you know? As I was saying before, like, there's definitely people making good music, but that doesn't necessarily make it, you know, equivalent to the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, man, this has been great. Let me throw you one annoying one to finish.
Sure.
What are your... Okay, name me... okay, I was going to say name three, but name me a few tunes that have come out in the last 10 years. The kind of the period that we've been talking about, right? Since everything went shit.
Yeah.
Name me a few tunes that have bucked that. Name me a few tunes that have bucked that trend that jump out to you in that period.
Oh, yeah, that is a really difficult one. Mainly because I'm just so bad at remembering stuff like that now and kind of putting my finger on stuff. Let me try and think of some. I can definitely give you some artists. I think Nicky Nair,
yep,
I think, is doing some incredible stuff. Obviously, I love his EP on Astrophonica, but I think there's been a few Nicky Nair tunes that he's done that I can definitely see myself playing in another 10 years' time. And that's always the barometer, right? Can you see yourself playing it in another 10 years' time? I mean, I, do you know what? This is going to sound really bad, but I'm going to say another record that we put out.
That's okay. That's fine.
Swan Dive. Swan Dive by Sully is another one. That I just think could have...
I rate him as a producer, for sure.
I mean, his music could have come out 20 years ago, but it also sounds like it's kind of somehow from 20 years in the future. Which is, you know, that's definitely something I always look for music that I sign and release. Oh, mate, you've put me on the spot here, man. I really want to come up with some, like, really profound music. What has come out in the last 10 years? What date are we now? 2014.
Yep.
So it goes back to 2014. Mate, do you know what? There's so much that I honestly feel like my vision is somewhat clouded now. It's almost like not being able to see the wood for the trees. And I feel that when I'm sorting my DJ sets out sometimes. I'm just like...
I know the feeling.
I don't know what to play. I don't know what to play. I don't know what to put in my record box.
I mean, that suggests that things haven't been quite as bad as we've been making out, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. I think, you know what the difference is, and I think you talked about this with Sean Ronaldo, is it's the anthems that are missing.
Right. Yeah.
It's those ubiquitous tracks that are missing. So something like Benga and Koki, Night.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
Something like Warhead, you know?
Or something like Warhead, yeah, something like that. I'm not sure there's anything like that in my record box for the last 10 years. And that doesn't mean that they're not good records or good songs. It's just I think that due to the fact that there's just so much stuff now, it's hard for them to gain that momentum and that status.
Yeah.
What about you? I know you want to wrap this up, but what's in the last 10 years? What's really stuck for you?
It's hard. I tell you why I find it hard is because I've not really been in one place musically in that time. I've jumped about all over the shop. Like, I've been a techno DJ in that time. I've been making house at certain points. Like, in the last couple of years, I've really come back to bass music a lot. And like, it's difficult when you don't really know the audience reaction to things inside out. Because I don't think, like, if you played Warhead to someone, for example, who didn't know drum and bass, I don't think they'd say, wow, that's a huge record.
Mm.
You know, it's the, like you said, the context in which something sits, which is as important, I think, as anything else. And particularly with dance music, because there's the moments on the dance floor which people have to those records, which really kind of give them the kind of life that they then take on. You know, I mean, obviously
there's so much. There is so,
gone.
No, there's just so many more layers to it, and that's what I mean by context.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, man, I'm gonna call time on this because my back's about to break in half, apparently. So,
no doubt. You know what? Just before we do go, shout out to Komodo, I think, because Komodo has made some music in the last kind of 10 years, which I really think has been standout. That's one that just suddenly sprung to my mind. Sorry to just jump in there, but yeah, the Komodo stuff.
Yeah. I co-signed that.
Sort of 5 years ago. Yeah, amazing.
Awesome.
Wicked, man. It's been great.
Yeah, that was Fracture. What an interesting conversation. What a thoughtful guy. It was great to catch up with him, actually, after so many years. Wow. Yeah, the early 2000s periods of Shoreditch clubs was pretty amazing, actually, just in the amount of different cool stuff that was going on. Seemingly millions of regular club nights, just each with its own sound, of which Forward, obviously, was probably the most famous. But yeah, that Technicality night was also great. And there were just loads of others too. We touched upon possibly the dumbest ever Twitter pylon, actually, during that conversation. There was an article in RA a couple of years ago, I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe it was a bit longer, about the early rave scene, the early jungle scene in particular in London. And the author of it pointed out that there was a propensity of people to get mugged outside those raves. And Twitter decided that was like some kind of like racist take on the music scene, which is so, so dumb. I mean, tell me you never went to a rave in the early 90s without telling me you never went to a rave in the early 90s. But it also, it struck me, really said a lot about what those people think about street crime and who perpetrates street crime, right? Because I can tell you, as someone who grew up in London in the 90s, street crime is not a pursuit that was confined to one demographic group. It was absolutely a multicultural thing. And you were as likely to get mugged by a white youth as you were by anyone else, to be honest. So, yeah, I think people who reach for those particular stereotypes, well, it just says a bit more about them than it does anyone else, doesn't it, really? Anyway, that's enough for this week, isn't it? We will be back, same time, same place. Actually, before I go, a reminder that you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial. If you don't want to do that, if you can't do it, also, that's totally fine. Follow the show wherever you listen to this podcast, whichever platform you're listening to. Leave us a review or a rating. And join us in the Discord, hotflashrecordings.com/discord. I will see you back here, same time, same place, for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.